everyone, and welcome back to Filmstrips, the podcast that would just like to say that you're going to see the exact level of just how little knowledge I have of the WWE tonight. I'm Dave Babbitt, and yes, we're still in the midst of this very special series of bonus episodes in which we're taking a look at direct-to-video films in this instance. So you probably have, hopefully, if you've had an opportunity, you've listened to our previous ones taking a look at Last Man Standing, the PM Entertainment film that I did with James Rivnak, and the Tremors 2 Aftershocks episode I did with Mr. Christopher Martin in this instance. But I have another returning guest that you'll be familiar with here. He's joined us on episodes taking a look at Conan the Barbarian, Full Metal Jacket, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and there was one more, actually, I think we had you on much more recently for, and I'm now blanking for some reason.
I'm blanking on it too.
Yeah, okay, this feels, what happens when I don't research these things in advance? But yes, once again, Mr. Eric Jones is joining us in the car today. Mr. Jones, thank you very much once again for joining us here.
Oh, thank you again for having me. And it just came to my mind, it was Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within.
Right, yes, of course, how could we forget that one? In this instance, yes. Again, a vision of what theaters would end up being like during COVID times years beforehand, for other reasons. So in this instance, Eric, would you like to introduce which film we'll be taking a look at this time for this direct-to-video bonus series?
Okay, absolutely. So we will be discussing today the sixth and final film in WWE Studios Marine franchise, The Marine Six Close Quarters.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Directed by James Nunn, he of Tower Block, a film which I actually had the opportunity to watch that he co-directed last year that I had a chance to watch. Written by Craig Weldon-Ziak, hopefully I'm not completely botching that, and starring, in this instance, Mike the Miz Mizanin here, and Shawn Michaels and Rebecca Quinn. Now, my understanding in this instance is that all three of them are wrestlers. I'm somewhat familiar with Shawn Michaels, thus showing my age in this instance. I'm going to admit right up front here, The Miz and Ms. Quinn are ones I am not super familiar with in this instance here. I take it, though, from my understanding, you are a bit more of a WWE fan than I am offhand, Eric.
Yes, and that is, I would say that's correct. And the funny thing is, I've actually sort of become a WWE fan pretty much because of the pandemic, because, over the last year and a half at the time, that was about the only thing that was putting out new material each week. It just became the thing that, like, me and my wife were just watching, and I mean, we got hooked on it. And I mean, obviously if I were to talk to like some other wrestling fans, they would probably say, yeah, WWE is not what it used to be. And I probably would agree with that, but I've enjoyed it during this time. And so, yes, I'm very much familiar with The Miz and Rebecca Quinn, or as she is, as Rebecca Quinn's her real name, but her performer name is Becky Lynch. And so I'm familiar with both of them. The Miz, he's been around a good while, since about 2005, 2006, and Becky Lynch has been around since about 2015 or so, and she's actually out at the moment on maternity leave. So one thing that the energy now that the WWE has moved back into stadiums for touring, people are eagerly awaiting her return. So they're both two of the more popular WWE performers out there right now. And as you mentioned, you said you were familiar with Shawn Michaels, and most people who follow wrestling know of his legendary status.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because for me personally, I was never a major wrestling fan. My brother, on the other hand, watches it weekly himself, and is very much a fan. But it's one of those things where I was kind of at the era when Hulk Hogan, that sort of classic late 80s era, early 90s era wrestling, was still sort of like the thing that imprints, is the first thing that appears in my mind there. Like the whole I knew of things like the Stone Cold Steve Austin era, and obviously Dwayne The Rock Johnson grew well beyond the ring, so it was kind of impossible not to know who he was after a certain point. But that was a point where it's like, I knew it was around, I knew it had an audience, but I wasn't necessarily part of that audience at the time. Mostly because, as we'll discover over the course of this episode, I may not know my wrestlers, but I know my British character actors. And by God, they are in this film quite extensively, despite being a US set movie in many regards. We'll get into that. But yeah, so I guess to sort of back up here to get things going, the question I've sort of been asking each guest as they've joined me here is, direct-to-video is one of those things where, particularly for people of our generation, we sort of have general expectations and familiarity with it. I mean, what was your general experience with straight-to-video films over the years, and how do you sort of view them as a whole, I guess, right now?
I guess my first instinct is when I think about when I was a kid, the first direct-to-video thing that felt like a big thing for me at my young age was when Disney released The Return of Jafar, the sequel to Aladdin. That was the first thing that felt like, oh, okay, you know, I mean, my parents probably would have taken me to see it had that become a theatrical movie anyway. But the fact that, wow, studios are releasing, they're not just making up movies to put here, they're making movies, bringing movies straight to the home viewing of like their big, you know, their big things. And and like using Return of Jafar as an example, it's not as high a quality as Aladdin. It definitely, at least in terms of like the animation itself, at the very least, if you're going to talk about it like that. But it was, you know, it was solid. And I think over the years, there was a period where I was fine with it. And then there was a period when I started to see more like, I guess, bigger stars seem to move to direct to video as like a later stage in their career. And I somewhat began to attach things, you know, some negatives with it. You know, I think about Bruce Willis's career and how pretty much his entire like post Pulp Fiction career has been direct to video stuff. And it just seemed like he was just, you know, seems like he's just taking whatever he could, you know, whatever he could get. And it seemed like people or filmmakers or whatever, or studios were just doing, you know, whatever they want. And I think over like the last few years, my appreciation for it has actually kind of gone back up as I've gotten older and my cinematic interests aren't just simply what is released in theaters, not just the blockbusters, not just the awards fair. You know, we've talked on Twitter many times, not just as far as films go, but even as things as comics. I think you understand that. Like, for example, I have a taste in some of like more lower budget pulp type qualities in certain media. And I think a lot of some of the direct-to-video things now are doing that. And I think about something like Troma back in the day, or Canon back in the day, and how those, those may be some low budget films, but even they weren't all necessarily direct to video, but you know, there's that low budget quality, that low budget, I guess, sentimentalism, I guess you could think about it. And I think seeing that in a lot of direct to video stuff now, I think it also just allows for people to, studios or filmmakers to get ideas out that they wouldn't necessarily normally get out. As you know, another thing that I love, and we've talked about it many times, are the DC Universe direct to video films.
Yeah.
I love those because even though we're in an era of superhero blockbuster, but you're not going to be able to get every single one of those ideas to the big screen. And that particular line of films allows you to, just get something. You can make a movie about Constantine or a movie about the Teen Titans or whatever, and you can get away with stuff like that. And I think direct-to-video just allows people to, I guess, you just have just different type of movie experiences that you probably won't get. So I think, like I say, that I thought it was great when I was a kid, and then I kind of fell off on it. But I think as my own movie tastes have expanded over the years, I've come to gain a big appreciation for it. And believe it, and I'm watching the whole Marine series lately. I realized that there is a I guess that there is a form to it. There's a form to it that's you don't really consider, because you're usually just trying to think of, oh, this movie, it just came straight to video because they knew it wasn't going to fly well in theaters. But one thing I've learned with the Marine series is that, this was a series that started in theaters and from the second entry on became a direct-to-video series. And I think something interesting about it is, as the series went on from 2 through 6, you kind of see how it got comfortable and confident in the type of film it was, or the type of film series that it was going to be. So I think, especially now with we're in a pandemic, and I think the idea of direct to video, not just for stuff that would have been in cinemas, but I think it actually is something that should be. I mean, shoot, even if you think about stuff like Netflix now, you could say that is a new form of direct to video. I mean, it's streaming and it's at, it's widely accessed, but think of something like that, the Fear Street movies that have just come out, or that would definitely be a good example of a direct to video approach. So I think it's something that's adapted over the years, and I think with the way viewing habits are changing, I think it's actually going to play a bigger part now, a bigger role in how people consume it now than ever before.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of what sort of encompasses what you're talking about here is this idea of sort of the growth of the niche market is becoming the dominant form of it, because it seems like the idea of the sort of four quadrant blockbuster, the film that, will hit a mass audience, is seems to very quickly be eroding at a rapid rate here. And particularly, I mean, with the always the possibility that the pandemic itself will keep carrying on for an extended period of time for reasons that we won't get into necessarily here, without derailing things. I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, I think like a lot of what we're going to be seeing here is, you look at things like the fact that they are Universal's investing $400 million in producing an Exorcist trilogy from David Gordon Green and Jason Blum. And let me be clear, I like David Gordon Green as a filmmaker. I really loved his 2018 Halloween take. I question how financially viable $400 million being spent on an Exorcist trilogy of sequels will be, in the grand scheme of things. And that's where the thing where looking at things like, the straight-to-video market, where, not only has that sort of the division between what constitutes straight-to-video changed, they're honestly probably the more economically responsible and feasible films in the long run going forward, which makes me wonder, when the inevitable implosion happens in the next probably decade or so of the Hollywood system. Will it be the straight-to-video production companies that are going to be the ones that really start picking up the slack in a lot of these ways? Or will their at least methods and approaches to doing things become the new sort of foundation for, what we can sort of consider in terms of ongoing filmmaking as a commercial enterprise, which much to be said about that. I think we'll definitely get into that there. But I think what you're also pointing here to definitely brings us to the Marine itself in particular, because if we're talking about niche audience here, I mean, obviously the big thing to get into with the Marine franchise overall, and particularly as we get to into the sixth one, Close Quarters here, is the fact that it is very much a film series that's being made for one very particular audience above and beyond anything else. And that's basically been the core of what the series has been since day one, as long as with most other productions from the production company WWE Studios, and that is World Wrestling Entertainment fans in this instance there. And it's I'm very curious to see, because I'm not sure, again, WWE Studios is something that's actually reasonably recent in terms of sort of existing, because it only really comes into existence in 2002 at that point in time. And very shortly, I believe it's 2006 when the first Marine film comes out there with John Cena, who I swear seems to be taking the long path towards mainstream success, it feels, in terms of how his career has developed over the years. Because really, like, right now, it feels like this is supposed to be his breakout year in 2021. But I mean, with, you know, Fast and the Furious 9 and now The Suicide Squad and the Peacemaker show coming up. But it's like, yeah, no, he's been at this for a solid 15 years here of trying to break into Hollywood. And I guess that sort of brings us to the, you know, to the sort of notion of what the studio itself was, which was this idea of sort of finding a way to segue and build out these wrestling brands, these different stars that the World Wrestling Entertainment had sort of been developing over the particularly the preceding decade leading up to that there. Because certainly, you know, the WWE, or as it was known at once upon a time, the WWF, had certainly made its way trying to break its wrestlers out into the larger stardom. Probably the most famous one of my youth certainly was Hulk Hogan. And there's somebody that they tried to build out through things like, hey, guess what? He's in Rocky III. And then going on to build him out and put him into things like Suburban Commando.
Suburban Commando.
Yes. That will, I love that that's always going to be like, that was the high watermark for Hulk Hogan overall there. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That was the big thing. And it sort of worked, it seemed, for a time. But these were often cases where the WWF really wasn't in control of its stars and what they were, what their image was going to be, and how they would sort of place them in the public at large. And under the leadership of Vince McMahon, he of many dubious and questionable ethical practices, he certainly, you know, over the time, eventually the rebranding of the WWF into the WWE, sort of that signifying of that we're admitting that, yes, wrestling isn't necessarily a sport as it is an entertainment franchise, as it were, at this point. And just sort of accepting or admitting to the public at large that, yes, this is what we are, sort of signaled that shift. And then the early 2000s is really the point where they start trying to suddenly take a far more control over these things and sort of integrating it into the larger entertainment world, as it were. Certainly by doing things like, for example, cross-promoting with different feature films like Highlander Endgame with Triple H, which led to the absolutely weird moment that I did watch, admittedly, even as a non-wrestling fan, which was Christopher Lambert and Adrian Paul showing up on the WWE program on, I think it was still UPN at that point, during that time, as a to watch a Triple H wrestling match there and promote the film. And then eventually, of course, Dwayne The Rock Johnson with The Scorpion King being sort of that big play to sort of get him into the public at large. But this sort of brings us, yes, to WWE Studios, the creating of an actual production entity for to produce content, both for presumably the WWE's various other brands and television programs, but also to make a stab at being a legitimate film production unit. So obviously, our big starting point here is going to be the Marine 6 to get into this. But let's sort of, since you've watched through the whole Marine series within a very short period of time here, and I've only seen half of it in this instance, sort of beginning, middle, and end, as it were. The 2006 films. So, I mean, this was my first time watching this year. Was this your first time watching it through for this run through?
Yes. Yeah, this was my first time with the entire series. Prior to watching that, my wife and I, we had watched another WWE Studios film with John Cena, 12 Rounds.
Ah, yes.
And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that one. And I was like, you know, let me find out about the Marine series. So like I said, you know, this right now is the year of John Cena. So I was like, yeah, that was his first, the Marine one was his first acting role, and I was like, you know, let me go see what this is about. And I have no problem checking out anything. I'll buy a Blu-ray or DVD of any movie, especially if it's cheap and I have
Yep.
interest. And I found all six movies very cheap. Spent less than $20 for like the entire series.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I'm in this for the I'm in this for the long haul. And the first Marine, funny thing about the first one, for a movie that's supposed to be like, you know, introducing the world to like the cinematic John Cena, he actually kind of well, he doesn't stand out too much in it. Robert Patrick actually steals the whole show
Yes.
for that entire film. Everybody else was told to they were in one type of action film, and someone told Robert Patrick that he was in a parody of action films. And I don't know how it I mean I enjoyed it only because I'm like, I don't know if that movie was intentionally meant to be like what it was. I thought it was going to be like a kind of a more straightforward action film, which is actually what the rest of the series is. This one is totally different in tone. I remember thinking, I was like, this is like someone trying to imitate Michael Bay, and it ends up looking comical. So that was my thoughts on the first one. The second one, John Cena is not the lead in the second one. This is Ted DiBiase Jr., son of the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. And that one actually plays like that was the first direct. The Marine 2 is the first direct-to-video film. The Marine 1 is the only one that was released in theaters. So the Marine 2 plays a lot like, believe it or not, it plays a lot like Die Hard, and it's actually based on a the plot of it is actually based on like a true story about these people that were like held hostage at some resort or something like that. But it plays kind of almost like Die Hard, and you have Jango Fett himself, Temuera Morrison, as the villain. And then that one was that I enjoyed that as well. That was definitely far more realistic. And believe it or not, as even though Cena has a very buff physique, I thought DiBiase did a better job like handling the physique in the Marine 2.
Okay.
The Marine 3, Homefront, that's the first one with The Miz,
Yeah.
Mike Mizanin. And that is the first one I think that tries to, I think that's the first one that tries to play itself as, I guess it tries to give character since, I mean, we didn't know it at the time, but Mizanin's Jake Carter will be the main character throughout the rest of the series. So, you know, they introduce us with, you know, we're introduced to his family and his friends as he returns home from his military service. And we have the patron saint himself, Neil McDonough, as the villain. Very good villain, you know. And I'm surprised that for the fact that these first three movies have pretty well-known names as the villains. And then Marine 4, Moving Target, that is actually like my second favorite of the series. It's very much like First Blood. The majority of the film takes place in the woods, and there's a lot of setting traps and tree logs falling on people and things like that. I don't, that probably had about the least, maybe one of the least interesting villains. Jake Carter is protecting a whistleblower. And so I just thought that one was just for a fact that it seemed like it didn't have much in terms of any sort of plotting or anything like that. I thought it was just a lot of just good action. So I enjoyed that one. The Marine 5, what was 5 called?
Battleground,
Battleground.
yeah.
Yep, Battleground. Jake Carter is now an EMT. And he basically spends the night in this parking garage taking on this biker gang. That was probably like my least. I just didn't find too much of the action or like the villains themselves compelling. And then Marine 6, Close Quarters, the final film. This was the one that jumped 4 to be my favorite, and I think it's the best. I think it's the one where they kind of really put some legitimacy in terms of just what what they were shooting, and maybe that's due to having the same director as Battleground returning. Maybe there was just some familiarity there, but I thought that having Shawn Michaels as Jake's former commanding officer, it gave a good level of he provided some good levity there. In the other films, when Jake has worked with others, it's just kind of, it's just kind of here and there. But, Shawn Michaels, and I'm sure they probably did it with him being a legend in the business, to give him just something of weight. And then to cast Becky Lynch as the villain, and I thought she did it like a really good job. At the this film was released in 2018, so I don't believe that at Becky Lynch's current her gimmick in WWE is she's the man. And I don't think she had the man gimmick at the time of this. I haven't watched everything, so I'm not 100% sure on the timeline of, when they do character changes and stuff like that. But having watched enough of her, it seemed like this was her performing that persona. And, the film actually felt like it had some stakes. In the other films, especially in the first two films, they both essentially deal with like a kidnapped wife. Not that, and it's not like we haven't seen that before. I mean, we haven't, it's not like we haven't seen a kidnapped kid in an action movie either. But I thought Six here did a very good job of providing some stakes. And then at about the, I guess you could say it's about the, at the end of the second third of the film, at the end of the, yeah, the, yeah, about say the end of the second third, about the beginning of the final third of the film, we get a big game changer, which I would never have thought that. I mean, I could expect that game changer obviously if this was a theatrical series, but I just wouldn't assume that some that they would do this in, especially in the final film of their series. I don't know. I don't know if you want. Do you want me to mention it now, or were you saving that if we talk about the plot a little bit later? I wasn't sure.
Well, hold on that one and put a pin in it for now, because you're absolutely right. I think that
Okay.
one's definitely worth going into. I think that you to sort of go with you there. I'm in full agreement with pretty much everything you're saying. I guess to go back to the series, overall context here, you're right. I only watched the first third and sixth films here, so sort of the start of the Miz era and the John Cena original there. And you're absolutely right. I mean, just to, so we're clear for everybody here, there is no, with the exception of once we get to the Miz and it's Jake Carter as our hero throughout the series, the first few films, there the only thing that really ties them together is the fact that they are about Marines here. And sort of the key thing is you might hear that title and you might sit there and think a couple things. First of all, these are going to be war-based films, and the truth is they're not at all. And in fact, in this case, because they're all set on American soil, they're all about either Marines who have retired, been discharged by choice or not by choice, or have sort of retired and moved on, or on vacation even. It's like, well, this is our R&R time. So that's sort of the consistency of just seeing, well, what happens when you turn a Marine loose, to deal with domestic issues, it seems here, and living out the power fantasy of, and this would solve everything, in this instance. And yeah, I would say that what sort of interested me is that first film, you're quite right. I strongly suspect it was intended as parody. Like, there's, and I the reason I am willing to go that far is their screenwriter on that film is Alan B. McElroy, there, who worked on things like the Spawn animated series as well as the Spawn feature film, worked on the wrong a couple of the Wrong Turn films, including the very first one of that. Every interview I've ever struck me, he always seems to be somebody who has his tongue very firmly in cheek, about what he does as a writer. So I wouldn't be surprised if he took this job, with the idea of like, I'm gonna take the Mickey out of this, because there is just some weird stuff in that first movie in terms of dialogue and character choices. A bizarre running subplot about rock candy that w ends on a weird, weird, disturbing note. It's just a bizarre film. The first of, to come back to the Marine 3, though, the first that introduces the Miz's character of Jay Carter, that was probably more the film I felt that I figured the first one was going to be, which plays into this very, you're right in this, in how it sort of it tries to build out a character and build a sense of, you know, this is where he's from, this is what the world he comes from, and this is his support network. What sort of surprise, you know, definitely occurred to me, though, is that it very much plays that sort of folksy Americana in a way that definitely the first film certainly doesn't there. And that definitely changes by the time you get to the sixth film, where it's very much about the, you know, big open pastures. It's the big small town. Everybody, you know, knows one another. Your good friend is the best, is the sheriff of the town. And it definitely plays with that. And I think the thing that sort of surprised me watching is that the Miz, and maybe you'll disagree with me on this, it didn't strike me that he was the most comfortable in that role, in that first one where he's doing it. And I couldn't tell whether it's a case of he's just learning his craft of being a screen actor as opposed to performing in front of a large stage, or if it's a case of the type of character he's playing doesn't quite fit. Because my understanding is his stage persona is quite different from the character he's playing in these films here. I don't know if you're able to speak to that or not in terms of that, Eric.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So yes, the Miz, as in the man who will get on, who's in the WWE ring. So the persona of the Miz is that of this movie star. When his music hits, you'll hear like the stagehands announcing quiet on the set. Can we have quiet on the set?
Okay.
You know, one of his nicknames is the A-lister. So he acts like this obnoxious dude bro movie star. And so that's pretty, and his wife, who is also a wrestler, who was in the Marine 5, she had a short role in the 5th Marine film. So she comes out with him, and so, you know, he's like the you know, the big Hollywood star with the hot wife.
Yeah.
And so that is the complete opposite of the type of character that Jake Carter is. And I when I first watched Homefront, I thought that I was like, is it that he? I'm thinking it's like, kind of like what you just said, that he probably hadn't at the time gotten a handle on that type of, you know, low key type of character, because he's so used to playing this boisterous, basically this boisterous buffoon on, you know, in the ring. There's actually another movie from WWE Studios. It's a Christmas movie called Christmas Bounty that he stars in, and he basically plays like a, I forgot what it was. It was like a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
And it's a Christmas comedy, and you know, it's kind of cute. But he felt more charismatic in that role.
Yeah.
Because it was a type of character. It wasn't the same character, but it was a type of character that felt, I guess, more close to home for him. And it's interesting because I was watching, there was only like these two little 5-minute featurettes on the Close Quarters Blu-ray. I thought there was going to be something for some information, but turns out there kind of is. The Miz was talking about how when they practiced their moves for the movie, and a lot of the moves that they were using are similar to what they would use in the ring. Like, they showed him performing a drop kick, but he was explaining how he had to learn that a movie drop kick is not the same as a professional wrestling drop kick. So I could definitely see where in 3, and I don't think he ever really fully becomes that, I won't say he's uncomfortable in the role, I just don't think that it ever becomes that, it doesn't feel that lived in.
Yeah,
that's why I think that when having Shawn Michaels by his side
for yes.
the sixth film, it helped. I mean, it helps a lot, and it really elevates that, because Michaels, the Heartbreak Kid, he has the charisma that, you know, that will, that plays off of the type of low-key character that Carter's supposed to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, there's definitely he feels far more comfortable working with Shawn Michaels on screen, is that sort of buddy duo dynamic they've got going on throughout it there, which feels more, definitely lived in and definitely more believable than playing this sort of protective older brother to his one sister who's of nebulously defined age. I'm still not sure what her character age is supposed to be, but you know, you're absolutely right. And yeah, and I think that definitely, I guess, it sort of behooves us to get into this film proper here, because it really, as the nice thing about this, and I will say this, is that even though I did go out of my way to watch the third film to at least have a sense of knowing, it's like, okay, this is the start of basically the series proper as it will be going forward here. This is very much old school in its construction, where you do not actually have to have seen any of the preceding films to jump in with part six necessarily in this instance. Like, everything you need to know about what this film's going to be, you will be told it within the first 5 or 6 minutes there, and you'll be up to speed without having to worry about that. And how do we find ourselves being introduced to our hero of Jake Carter in this instance, and his former CO, Luke Trapper, because God, I love those names there in this instance, Eric?
I remember, just trying to think back real quick. I remember it looked like they were, oh God, were they like, what's the thing? Were they like going around? It was like visiting other veterans or something, or like visiting the home. I swear that's what it seemed like they were doing. It was like visiting the homeless or something. Like, I'm sorry, it's been like 2 weeks since I watched it, and I didn't watch it a second time. Yeah, but I thought that was like sort of like what they were doing, like visiting homeless vets or something.
Yeah, so the film opens up, we see them sort of in this sparring thing where we get to see them sort of doing their whole sort of buddy shtick, and we build it out, and it turns out that in this instance Luke Trapper works for the VA in this instance. And the sort of that's really the essentials of what you need to know. Carter, he's an EMT, but that's not really going to be immediately relevant for this film in this instance here. But he's basically Trapper's buddy, and they apparently have seats to go see some sort of, what was it, a basketball game, I think, and they basically, it's like, okay, can you just help me out with one thing, Carter? I gotta make a stop for the VA in this instance. There's this one guy we gotta go see here, who's basically living in this abandoned building. And that's the one thing I will say that definitely I noticed between both the Marine 3 and the Marine 6, that is probably one of your telltale signs that you are watching a DTV film, and that is, we have found the most stunning, you know, abandoned location that basically nobody is using, where the majority of this film is going to be set. In the Marine 3, it's a boat that never moves. Here, we get in an abandoned building in this instance. And yes, they're effectively off to sea in this instance. The character of, blanking here? Tommy Walker, an old grizzled veteran himself, played by Tim Woodward. Now, worth noting here is that while you may not necessarily be familiar with Tim Woodward, chances are, if you're of a certain age, you might be familiar with his father, Edward Woodward, a.k.a. The Equalizer, from back in the 1980s there. So, folks, ask your grandparents. They'll probably know in this instance here. But that's not the only thing that's going on right now, because it seems that currently a crime boss of a nebulously defined criminal organization here, who in a detail I do like, we never actually see the defendant in this entire film. Like, normally this would be the sort of thing where if it was a Hollywood film, we'd keep cutting back into the courtroom, and they would have, you know, basically been giving like a payday to, I don't know, Eric Roberts or someone there. It's like, yes, you're going to be on the set and you're not going to be delivering any lines. Just look menacing the whole time here. that's not quite what we get in this instance. We just know that this trial's going on for someone who has gone around. He's murdered a number of individuals. The goal is to put him in prison. It seems like it's a slam dunk case. But what seems to be the problem here in this instance, Eric?
So yes, the person on trial is the father of our antagonist, Maddie Hayes. Maddie Hayes. Yeah. Becky Lynch's Maddie Hayes. And so Maddie arranges for this young girl, Sarah. She's kidnapped because her father is one of the jurors, and they want this juror to get the jury hung or like force a mistrial or something like that. So Maddie's father goes free.
Kind of like what you said.
The fact that, you know, normally in a movie like in Hollywood, this girl that would be kidnapped would probably be a judge's daughter or a lawyer's daughter or something like that. But it's real. It feels, I guess I said, it feels real random. And I guess it makes the stakes feel a little more, it doesn't feel like it's a forced drama because, you know, there's nothing special about this, this juror. They just kidnapped his daughter. You know, they just kidnapped his daughter. They could have kidnapped any juror's child. They just kidnapped, it's just random that they kidnapped this man's daughter and are forcing him to like hang the jury. And we do get a scene of that where in the juror room where he is the only one that says, I'm sorry, I don't see it. So it was a nice touch to add, like I said, to add a little a sense to the stakes that are here, because it just doesn't feel like a forced action drama. Maybe that's just because of the low budget nature of it. But I think it was just a very good creative stroke to use.
Well, it definitely keeps the stakes relatively simple. Like this is like the plot is not going to be a twisty turny type one where, you know, they've chosen this, as you're quite right, you know, they've just chosen whoever seems to have randomly had a child or somebody that they could target in this instance. And that's the sort of thing is when we take a look at our rogues gallery of villains in this film, I mean, even though, you know, they are working for presumably the mob, they don't come across as like, this isn't Spectre. This isn't some larger than life organization we're going up against here. This is basically just a very ruthless gang of individuals who, we murder, we kidnap. This is our job. And if it seems to work for us, we don't need to make it any more difficult for ourselves than this in this instance. And certainly, I mean, the individuals, the Sarah they kidnap is played by Louisa Connelly Burnham in this instance, who I'm not familiar with her other work beyond this. She's a young actor. She's supposed to be playing about sort of 15, 16, somewhere in there. So very young in this instance. However, I was excited to see who's playing her father in this film, and that is Alec Newman, a.k.a. the Paul Atreides that everybody seems to forget exists from John Harrison's 2000s miniseries adaptation of the novel Dune way back when. He also appears in about 3 or 4 episodes of Enterprise Season 4 as one of the other set of augments other than Khan that Captain Archer and company end up running into and eventually kidnap Data's great-great-grandfather in this one. So extra points for nerd appeal in this instance here, WWE Studios.
that's actually my father's, that sci-fi, the miniseries version of Dune, that's actually my father's favorite live action version.
Oh, nice.
Of the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never seen it, and I've never seen David Lynch's version either, but yeah.
See, I love the Lynch version, but I also admit the Lynch version will probably make no sense to anybody who's not read the novel because they condense so much into it, but it's just a thing of breathtaking beauty. The 2000s miniseries will make far more sense. And it's one that actually, because it knows it doesn't have the kind of budget to compete with a Hollywood production, it full on braces the artifice of it, and it almost gives it like this very stage theatrical quality to it. But it's got a hell of a cast, including William Hurt and oh, why am I blanking on his name? Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. Bond's Italian contact.
Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I do know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm blanking there. I feel bad about this, but yeah, highly worth checking out there, folks. But yes, so they're kidnapped, and where are they going to be? Happen to be setting up their base of operations? Well, wouldn't you just know it? It's going to be on the top of the building of where Jake and Trapper are going to be going to visit this fellow veteran of theirs, and. Particularly at this point, the reason Trapper wants Jake to come along with him is it turns out it's not just because it's like, well, I've got one little stop to make. It's that, by the way, you were basically served with this guy's son, Jake. So maybe you can talk him out of, you know, choosing to live basically out in the middle of nowhere with nothing here and sort of reconnect with society in this instance, which... Okay, I mean, it works in terms of the sort of setup as to why these characters would be here, why this is going on, and even if it's working on coincidence, the thing I quite like about this early portion of the film is it does take the time to build up these characters and the situation itself quite a bit in terms of our heroes here, where, yeah, they're basically dealing with a man who himself is struggling with PTSD, Velosa family, and they just trying to connect with him and basically failing in the course of this. Like, I mean, it's, you know, is it high art writing? No, but it's a better than you would honestly anticipate type of scene in terms of the drama for this kind of film. Certainly, where, yeah, they are delivering the fact that, yeah, no, this guy, it's like, well, we tried to help him. He just doesn't want to, you know, he just doesn't want to reach out. He doesn't want to connect, but we don't give up. And they're about to exit along with their, I forget the name of the guy who lets them into the gates, who's, was it like Gary or something like that? They're dealing with, who's just sort of deliberately kind of comedically obnoxious when dealing with. But sure enough, they hear something upstairs, which inspires our characters to head on up and check things out. And after a brief scream for help in this instance, they bust into the room. And wouldn't you know it, there happens to be Maddie with her crew, with Sarah holding her gunpoint. And here the film sort of... in terms of the conflict of the film sort of begins proper here. And again, I gotta say, there are a lot of things that this film does right off the back. And I do think credit has to go to James Nunn. Having seen Tower Block, which is another sort of very confined drama involving a sniper attacking people on one particular floor of this building in an English high rise, you see him sort of applying the same tactics here where... he knows he cannot necessarily, you're not going to be able to afford tons of explosions and gunfire and that. So they construct the actual scenario and build up the rationale for why things happen the way they do and why things are sort of very personal and driven in this instance very clearly. So, for example, why aren't you going to see a lot of gunfire in this film? Because quite reasonably, the villains of this movie do not want to kill Sarah because she's basically the trump card that they need to ensure this situation here. Hence why when we have a lot more fisticuffs in this film as opposed to gunfire and car chases and anything of that nature. Not to say that this film will be completely without those things, though. We do have a climax to get to. But we certainly have that. And to come back to what you were saying earlier about sort of a diehard comparison for the second one, I think certainly you can sort of see a similar diehard approach in this film as well, where it's effectively, you know, the majority of the film is built around these three characters of Jake, Trapper, and Sarah trying to navigate the building, avoiding the various foes along the way, and just trying to survive throughout it. So would you agree with that assessment, or would you see there sort of being more of a distinction there?
No, I'm in full agreement, and definitely with, like you said, how the film takes its time. It's crazy because it's only like an hour and a half, and they pretty much are trying to get pretty much with all the Marine films, they relatively get into the thick of it pretty quick. But because this one takes a little bit of time, and like you said, with Jake Trapper and Sarah, we've seen this in a lot of films. Like you said, you brought Die Hard up. You know, you think about those dynamics between like McClane, Holly, and oh God, Hans. I was forgetting Alan Rickman's character that quick. And it's really condensed form of like blockbuster filmmaking that they do here, because they have a lot of the check marks, a lot of the checklist here, and they hit them very quick because they know that they have to get it done within the hour and a half, and know that they're trying to, we always like to say, this movie knows what it, this movie knows what it is, but, especially at this point, because this is the sixth film, these Marine films know, they became comfortable with what they were, what they were and what they're trying to achieve, and I think that really has become something sort of admirable. You had mentioned the director, James Nunn, and what was the name of the film that you had mentioned that you recently watched?
Tower Block, yes.
Okay. And even though I wasn't as huge a fan of the fifth Marine film, I thought it was, I did think, because I love a movie that's really, I love a movie that's in a confined setting, so any movie that kind of, that takes place like that usually has my attention. But I thought the fifth film also did good in, I guess, establishing the randomness of how the plot can begin.
Okay, yeah. And that's, I would say, I can't speak necessarily to the fifth film itself, but I would certainly agree with you here that definitely, he has a good sense of also, like, sort of spatial dynamics in terms of the setting here, because one of the problems I found with part three, and particularly with the boat setting, is that, again, the way that film's director approaches it was very much, well, we set the camera down and we just sort of shoot and, lighting be damned, and that it's like, it doesn't matter if it's in the middle of a bright day. We just need to follow behind a guy. He goes in one side, he goes out the other. There's not really much, play with how we're going to stage the sequences here. Here, none really feels it's like, okay, we need to outline sort of what the geography is, what are some of the elements, and I can almost see him probably working with the screenwriter sort of going through, here's our space, how can we construct our set pieces around taking advantage of what's actually there? We got a grain silo, perfect, how do we work that grain silo into our film in this instance here?
That was actually I actually thought that was a really great sequence, from the whole going down, that them trying to get down the elevator shaft to end up in the silo. And when Trapper, when he falls down, you kind of, I guess because of the way Nunn shoots it, you feel the concern, you feel the concerns that they have having to navigate down this elevator shaft and, how far it is a drop.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it probably helps as well that Nunn seems to realize that, and I think this is the danger that occasionally happens, particularly when you look at things like the early films of The Rock necessarily, where one of the things about, Dwayne Johnson is he is a superhumanly big, imposing person. And a lot of wrestlers have a physique that, sort of gives them that almost superhuman quality here. The way Nunn stages a lot of the action is, even though, Shawn Michaels and The Miz are these really bulked up guys in this instance, they take a pounding in this film. Like, they, just because they're strong doesn't mean they get hurt. And this, when, Michael's character Trapper falls down this thing because the villains are basically throwing big bags of grain on top of him just to knock him down the chute. Yeah, he gets impaled coming down hard on this thing, and they don't ignore the fact that he gets buggered up by that. And again, little attentions to detail where it's like, yeah, this has happened, we're still gonna need to get you to a hospital, because, literally, first of all, don't take that out. Why did you take that out? That is not going to help you in this instance. Just all those small little details add up. And this is kind of the thing I also really appreciate about this film, because up to this point, as I'm watching it, one of the things they're very clearly building up throughout the film and something that is very savvy is something that you're probably going to be expecting from the start, whereas we've got an older CEO character, and then we've got The Miz, the hero of this series, there, the younger guy here. They keep trading banter about, like, stories from the old days and how he owes the captain and how the captain owes him and all these back and forth here. And it's really setting you up with the expectation that eventually, before this film is over with, Shawn Michaels' CEO, Jake, or Trapper in this instance, is going to bite the big one to make sure that Jake gets through and saves the day. There's going to be that heroic sacrifice. And you see all the legwork they set up for this, for all the things of, like, how they're buddy-buddy with one another. The little small gags where, you know, we suddenly see Luke having to switch. Once they actually do end up meeting up again with Tommy Walker again, who finally decides to join them and in their crusade to sort of help this young girl. You know, he's got one shirt that Luke can switch into, which is what was like World's Best Grandma or something that. Throughout the rest of this here, and all these little things where it's like, oh, I better not die in the shirt. Like all the little signifiers that leads you to believe that's where this film's going to go. And again, you know, I will say this, I was willing to go with the film down this road where it's like, you're doing something I've seen before, you're in all this. I'm willing to, you know, but you're doing it well. You know what? When you get to that moment, you've earned that moment. And then the film does something completely different that I was not anticipating in this instance. Because basically, we get more or less a sort of series of cat and mouse moments throughout most of, like, I would say, in the next 30 to 40 minutes of the film, with them sort of ducking from one room to another, getting into fights with certain goons, and getting taunted by Rebecca Quinn's villain throughout this film. They do manage to make it outside. Tommy Walker sacrifices himself in order to make sure that they can escape into these underground tunnels here that they have to, that are maze-like, and they have to go on in this instance. And eventually, through a series of situations, basically Jake, Sarah, and Luke are all trapped underground here, pinned down here. And what happens at this moment, Eric?
Well, we have Jake, who ends up shot and he's bleeding real heavily. And after a few moments of exchanges and I get, you know, goodbyes, Jake runs out into the gunfire to provide cover for Luke to get Sarah out. And Jake is shot and he falls to the ground. And then Maddie comes over and she has a knife and she throws a knife into his heart. And Jake Carter is dead. The man who we have followed through these four films, through Marines 3 through 6, the lead character, the man who, once he came on the scene, that's who the series was about. They killed off the main character. And I was shocked, because if your main character does a sacrifice, they do it at, you know, they do it at the end. They had their big moment, and not that this wasn't a big moment, but, you know, they had their big moment at the end of the film, and that usually signifies that the evil has been vanquished or whatever. Here, that's not the case. The hero is gone, and the mentor is still here. It would be like if in Star Wars, A New Hope, if Vader killed Luke and Obi-Wan continued the rest of the film. That was such a shock. And now that I think about it, when you were just describing when Luke falls down the elevator and he's impaled, now when that scene happened, I actually thought that he was dead then, because usually in a movie, that's what would happen. I thought he got impaled and he was going to say, oh no, it's too late, kid, go on, get this girl out of here, get her safe, and that was going to be his end. But he wasn't, and he got, you know, he got right up, and he pulled the bar out. And so now that I realize it, that was a really genius move. And Yao used the term genius move to start, you know, to set you up for this big switcheroo that they're about, you know, that they're going to do. And I just was like, wow, that's a gutsy move for a direct-to-video line to do. You know, even I think about like with the DC animated films, the Dark Side War.
Yeah.
That film was the final film in the shared continuity that they had started a few years back. But again, any deaths that happen in that, you know, you were expecting it because it was years of movies and years of buildup.
Yeah.
But, nobody expects in a Superman movie before we enter the third act, Superman is dead for good. You know, one's expecting something like that. And to do that, and I was just like, wow, they're really going to... That's a really good subversion. And it's one of them things that I kind of hope that more people do get to see. Well, hopefully everybody who's listening to this has seen the series. So I apologize. So we apologize for those of you
spoilers,
who have
folks.
Not. Yeah. We apologize for those of you who have not. But yeah, it's something that I hope people get a chance to see. Get to see how well done that was. I just wouldn't have never have expected at the end of like the second act of a film for the lead character to make the heroic sacrifice and the mentor character remain to carry the rest of the film.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I mean, it is the thing, you're quite right. I mean, there's those ways we expect it. So certainly the third act, you know, sacrifice is one thing, or in the case of, you know, the sort of when you soft reboot something and you have the handover moment there, whether it's again, second time I brought up Highlander Endgame in this entire episode, but you know, where Connor's got to die in order so that Duncan may be the hero now, or and less popular there, but if you've seen G.I. Joe Retaliation, where Channing Tatum puts in his contractually obligated 2 to 3 days on set just to kill Duke in this instance, so that The Rock may carry forward and carry that rest of that sequel through to its end. It's, yeah, you expect those things. And I would say even the difference with like the DC animated films in this instance is that even, you know, if they were to kill Batman or Superman in one of those films, you know, we all know that that doesn't mean there isn't going to be another Superman movie, coming down right. The line. You know, there's always going to be, well, that continuity is done. Let us bring on the next one here. This, you know, it's not like there's another 15 potential Jack Carter alternate universe films that are now going to be coming up here to replace it. So it definitely carries far more impact. I'd also say that this is kind of maybe the brilliance of the fact that when you're making a film this sort of under the radar, there, nobody really has time to bring expectations to it necessarily. Because, you know, the problem is with even the DC direct-to-video films, everybody's going to go through those trailers looking for each bit of minutiae to sort of start guessing through, well, what are the possibilities of the story? Where is it going to go? What changes have they made? Who knows where it's going to be? You watch the trailer for the Marine 6 and it's like, yeah, that looks like the Marine 6. Nothing leads you to believe that this is going to be that kind of big turn moment. And yeah, I have to say, you know, among the things I was not anticipating in 2021 was saluting WWE Studios for pulling off actually a shock and surprise to the system here. And I salute you, everyone over there, for pulling this one off. So this does leave us, though, then, yeah, with Shawn Michaels effectively as our lead for the rest of the film. And again, one of the things I like is that at this point, there is that major tonal shift that also happens as a result of this, where suddenly the jokiness that's sort of been throughout the film, the levity that's there, it's all gone at this point in time. And it's now just a straight ahead. Luke Trapper is now hellbent on just shutting this whole thing down as quickly as possible. And this does lead to, you know, a shootout near a boat. And ultimately, again, in a relatively impressive moment, him running after a boat and then having to make a leap from the dock to get onto a motorboat from the back of it in order to have this sort of like final mano a mano showdown to save Sarah, who the villains have once again managed to reacquire in this instance. Which, yeah, does lead to, again, a pretty decent fisticuffs between Shawn Michaels and Rebecca Quinn, which is one of those things where, again, because of the way so much of action cinema has sort of been trained us, you know, we don't typically see, you know, this man versus woman style physical showdown too often. It's become a bit more common recently, but typically, unless things have changed in the WWE, my understanding is that the women and men's divisions have remained very separate, usually in terms of the actual matches themselves. There, I could be wrong there. I don't know if you know can speak to that at all, Eric, or not.
No, you're correct. It's very, very rare that they do it, and like the most recent one I've seen was like last year or like earlier this year. But the gentleman that was in the ring, he's a Cirque du Soleil performer. So he gave. There was no offense that came from him.
Yeah.
So the women that he was against, it was only two matches that they did like that. So the offense really came from the women. His was a lot of defensive flipping and running and stuff like that. So yes, it's actually one thing that Vince McMahon is pretty adamant on. Yeah, he doesn't care to do much for like the, you know, mixed matches and things like that. They'll have it where it's like if it's like a tag team, but only the women can face the women or the men can face the men.
Yeah.
In a case like that. But yeah, the actual man versus woman matches, he doesn't he actually does not have a thing for those. So to see that in this film, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how much talk the, you know, the production people actually do with Vince McMahon. I would imagine he probably does. He has his hands in just about almost everything else of it.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that he does talk about this, and they probably had to really convince him as to the effectiveness of the filming and the scene to show how it works. And I think, and like you said, it's a really pretty good scene. And Rebecca Quinn, Becky Lynch, she's essentially the women's division's top performer. And, you know, as I said, we all know Shawn Michaels' status. So they probably really wanted to put on a good showcase, you know, between two top talents.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, and it's an unapologetic approach, because I could easily have seen, like, if this had been made, say, in the 1990s, there would have been a whole spiel about, oh, you would never hit a woman or things along those lines there. And the film is like, no, I'm a killer. You're trying to stop me. We're just going to go at it and just, you know, see, one of us is going to pound each other to death until the other is dead or walks away victorious in this instance. And I mean, for all of the film shocks, it's not going to be a surprise that, yes, Shawn Michaels does, you know, get away. It does win this fight, ultimately being our hero left standing at this point in time. Although that would have been one hell of an ending of this film if it was like, and no, and Rebecca Quinn's villain gets away with everything in this film. It's like, well, you a twist on top of a twist. You would have had us there, Marine Six. But yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, it is a pretty brutal fight. And yeah, this brings us to sort of like the sort of coda of the film here, where again, we sort of have this send off where we have Luke, Sarah, her father, and basically this sort of neat wrap up of, you know, what's happened, reporting to police. And then, of course, we get Luke saying goodbye to Jake's body as it's being carted off in this instance. And again, it's, so again, credit to Shawn Michaels here. He is acting his heart out. I mean, in this instance, is he going to be going up against Olivier anytime soon? No, but Olivier's dead, so I don't think that was a threat of happening. But I mean, but in this instance, I mean, but he delivers, you know, exactly what the moment needs in this instance. And again, we're all, you know, at about the 78 minute mark here when this happens, before we go into what closes out the film, which is effectively this music video montage of the memorial for Jake Carter, in this instance here. I was going to say his greatest hits, but that doesn't quite capture the sentiment that they're going for in this sort of send-off here. And yeah, I gotta admit, I mean, is it a bit cheesy in the execution? A little. But it does it. I mean, it actually gets it across. And again, I'm saying this as somebody who's missed two out of the four films that this character's been in here. So I'm unfamiliar with some of the clips that we've seen here. But I mean, you do get the sense of, yeah, there's been this legacy that's built up over the past like 6 years worth of movies for those who have been invested in it. And this film is legitimately taking it seriously that we want to pay off that, you know, the dividends on your investment here in this instance, which again, I mean, how does it strike you, Eric, in this sense? I mean, does this sort of final, having seen the whole series all through, does that sort of final montage work for you, or is it more of a maybe a bit too much?
Actually, I thought it was effective. I mean, now granted, it's not, I'm not gonna say it's the sign off of the original crew at the end of Star Trek VI,
yeah,
or the sign off, or the sign off of the original Avengers at the end of Endgame. But I will say it did feel good, because I sat there and I watched all six of these films, and I guess you could say, you know, we see it online. People talk about it online all the time, that, you know, we talk about how it's not easy to make a movie, and everybody who makes a movie, whether it's the largest of blockbuster or the shortest of short film, everyone puts their all into it, and everyone, you know, wants to show that, you know, the work that they did meant something. And even though we didn't have, say, a full-fledged character arc for Jake Carter, but we got four films with this character. And once you've decided to stick around, like, you know, if you watch Marine 3 and you decided, well, you know what, I'm going to stick around for 4, 5, and 6, it's almost like a thank you, a thank you to the character. And you could almost say a thank you to, I guess you could say, the fans. I don't know how many there actually are. Me and my wife might be the only two out there that might legit say we loved every moment of it. But still, it's a, I thought it was just a cool way of just saying, hey, you know, we may be low budget, we may be direct to video, just let you know, we meant everything that we put into these.
Yeah, and I would absolutely agree with it. I mean, it's sort of as a counterpoint to this film, I mean, that really goes to show that, I mean, you know, the success has very little to do with budgets when you get right down to it for films, is this past year's Mortal Kombat, which I would say, I mean, it's a very different film in some ways, but it's also a comparable, this is about fisticuffs fighting and presumably wanting some form of emotional investment from the audience in what we're seeing. And it just fails miserably right from the get-go. And again, I mean, it's not that, you know, it's a poorly made on a technical level. Like, there are very clearly talented people who are working on that film. And in terms of the costume designs, you even have actors who are trying their heart out to make this work. But there's just something so cynical and calculated, and just, you know, I mean, even just not interested in, you know, basically, you know, delivering even the most modest of fan expectations, where it's like, well, it's a fight movie, but we need a ton of spectacle and CGI, because that's what a real blockbuster is in this day and age. And yeah, I gotta say, I cared a heck of a lot more about, of all people, Jake Carter, as played by The Miz, than I care about, I honestly can't even remember what the name of the character Mortal Kombat film was. I believe it was Louis Tan who played him, if I'm remembering correctly in that case. But I'll have to take a look up and see what that character's name was, just so, you know, to be clear about that. But yeah, I mean, so, I mean, I gotta say, again, I was not necessarily anticipating the Marine 6 to be as good as it is, And I gotta say, Eric, thank you for having me picking this one to be the one to watch, because it certainly by far exceeded my expectations in ways I was not anticipating.
Oh yes, if like I said, like as I was going through, and I found all six of them enjoyable, but when we got to the end of six here, I was like, wow, it just felt like that one there was just something extra that they did for that, and it worked. Like I said, the having Shawn Michaels in there, that really, that elevated it a lot in terms of just character interactions, because, you know, for all the films up until that, even going back to the first Marine, the Marine character usually is just on their own. They're accomplishing these things on their own, and there's not much interaction. There's not much, you know, the character of Luke Trapper makes Jake Carter not feel, it makes, like, if you say you watch three and you're like, man, Jake Carter's a dull character, which wouldn't be an unfair assessment necessarily, but when you watch six, you'd be like, oh, okay, you know, having a character like Trapper beside him doesn't necessarily make him look dull. It just makes him, it just seems like there's two different, you know, they're two different people with two different ways of, I guess you could say, operating,
yeah,
whatever, in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, I mean, it just creates a context that brings out the better half and more engaging half of,
yeah,
the other character. Absolutely there. No, I would completely agree with that. And the character from Mortal Kombat that Louis Tan played is Cole Young. Yes, everybody's favorite, Cole Young. But
one of my biggest disappointments thus far this year.
Yeah, and I don't blame you. Somewhere, you know, again, when it comes to part two, Paul Thomas Anderson is still out there. You, yes, can hire him, Warner Brothers. But yeah, so I guess any final thoughts for the Marine 6 before we turn to hits and pits on this one?
You know, everyone out there, give the films a chance. I think that all of them are pretty short. Like, they're all under 2 hours, and I honestly don't think any of them will waste your time. But this one here, the Marine 6 Close Quarters, this is legitimately the best of them, and I think everyone will just be pleasantly surprised, if, you know, just surprised as they go through it. And that's just one other thing I just want to say, for direct-to-video, and although these aren't, the series as a whole, I'll say at least starting with two, do very, very well with their action, their way of grounding the action spectacle. I truth be told, I kind of wish some modern-day blockbusters would take note from that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. That is definitely the case. And hopefully, you know, we will, I mean, if nothing else, when the industry comes crashing down, it will be their time to shine and rise and be in demand, because basically that's all anybody's going to be able to afford to do, probably for a while. But on that, yes, I guess this brings us to the hits and pits here, where we celebrate the little things and condemn some of the other little things that we may have come across that we haven't done so far. So in this instance, Eric, what would you say is your first hit for the Marine 6 Close Quarters?
First hit would, and this actually won't just be for Marine 6, but I'm going to include it for the entire series as well. The villains, they may not have a whole lot of complexity or anything like that, but the series just has some pretty good villains in terms of just feeling like a villain. You know, you stated earlier, Robert Patrick is out of his mind in the first film. Tamara Morrison is really good in the second. Neil McDonough actually in the third kind of actually is the one villain that actually has a little bit of context to it. The fourth film doesn't really have too much in terms of villain. It's more of a mercenary group that's the villains. But it works because the film, like I said, the film is like First Blood. And then Becky Lynch here in six does really good at just giving some edge to an antagonist. So that would just, I said that would be my first hit, the villains of the series.
Yeah, I would absolutely definitely go with you with Lynch here as well, because she really is, like, you know, just full on takes command of the screen when she walks in, where it's like, no, I'm the alpha in this scene, and by God, everybody is going to pay attention to me and listen to what I have to say, and it just throws down in that regard. And I would definitely agree with you in this instance. For my first hit, I actually have to give it to the editor of the film, one Chuck Norris. Now, to be clear, it is not that Chuck Norris.
I had to look that up, though, because it honestly had me wondering. I was like, wait, really?
That's the thing. It's like, number one, I gotta salute you, sir, for deciding that that's the name you're gonna go with, knowing full well despite that, you're gonna get all the jokes you're gonna receive. And had it been the actual Chuck Norris, let me say, your editing techniques are actually much better than your acting. This film moves at a really nice clip, and the way in which the editing of the action sequences and the fisticuffs are handled, it's nice, clear, and kinetic without ever becoming chaotic there. Again, things that, you know, big mainstream films could really learn from. Like, watching Snake Eyes in theater was just, and watching how awfully they've edited those fights into the ground, it was just brutal here. Here, Norris really has a good command, and granted, he seems to have a lot of direct-to-video credits to his name. He's worked on things like Dragonheart Battle for the Heartfire, Silver Lake, Dragonheart Vengeance, and Man with the Iron Fist 2, so I suspect he's built up a lot of chops over time to realizing, you know, this is what's going to work best to make these kinds of films click here. So I do have to give him credit for crafting and working and putting together some really solid fight sequences throughout this film itself. But on that note, what would you say is your next, second and final hit for this one, Eric?
Second hit would be, we've talked about him all throughout, but Shawn Michaels. I think it's honestly probably the best acting performance in all the, you know, in all the films. Charisma goes a long way, and he's got that, and he's got that in spades in this film.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you here. And I mean, it's almost kind of a shame looking at it, realizing it's like, actually, yeah, you could have been maybe his screen persona is only really to work on films only developed recently, but I almost get the feeling like, you know, you probably could have been acting in feature films and television for a lot longer than this and been delivering quality work. So it's kind of shame to see, you know, him at this point where it's like, yeah, you have the chops and not really have a chance to develop them past this point. Because I suspect at this stage, he's not going to get his Dave Bautista moment or John Cena moment this late in his career, unfortunately. But no, absolutely. Thank you. Definitely would agree with you on that one for sure. On a similar note here, I am also going to give it actually here to our co-lead in this instance, Mike Mizanin, who, again, I was critical of his work in part three, but he really does come into his own, particularly by at least this film, if not sooner, because he really feels much more comfortable in front of the camera and playing the sort of, calling him Dudley Do-Right would be a bit much, but he's definitely a character who, you know, makes the right call at the right time at any given point here. And again, even being able to, you know, to have, you know, number one, the ability to deliver on his death scene and pay it off in the way it's handled, that's not necessarily an easy thing. And to have the ego, or to be the ability to park your ego to allow for that scene, because I could see certain performers sitting around and saying, like, no, I'm not going down in this. I got to be there to the third act. See Bruce Willis. I mean, here it's like, oh yeah, no, you want to kill me at the end of the second act? By God, yeah, I'll show up and do that. You know, credit to him. I mean, particularly knowing that it's like, this has been your series, four films in a row. Now, maybe he knew full well that this was the last one. It's hard to say whether they knew for sure this was going to be it or not at the time, because, again, there wasn't a lot of production context I was able to find, or you were able to find, Eric, on this one. So I don't know how much of it was we're hedging our bets versus Well, maybe we'll do the Luke Trapper spinoff if this thing sells enough copies there going forward. I guess we'll see in the next few years whether WWE Studios still sees any value in the Marine series going forward. Or rebooting it with John Cena once again. Who knows? But with that, this does bring us to the pits. What would you say is your first pit for this film here, Eric?
First pit would probably be the music.
Yeah.
I don't find I'm not a fan of I guess you could say it's overscored. It's just one of those cases where, like, you know, okay, sure, I want some rousing music for an action scene, but I'm gonna be like, yo, okay, you can dial it back. You could dial it back a little. There were a few moments, even with Jake's death scene, that the music just swelled, and I was just like, all right, look, you can back it off a little. I was like, you're kind of the moment is working with the acting alone, so it's like you could dial it back just a bit. So I'm gonna say the music will be my first pit.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, it's a trick to with these kinds of things. Like, I'm glad it's not like a very cheap sounding synth score, but yeah, it's definitely, yeah, there are moments where the music certainly gets overblown in this instance. I guess for mine, and I feel a little bad for doing it, but Louisa Connelly Burnham. Not that her performance is bad. She is good. But like we said, this is a movie that's set in America, but was shot in England. And that's why there's so many UK actors in this cast, including Connelly Burnham herself. And you can tell because there are moments when her accent slips hard throughout it. And I was trying to figure, it's like, are you supposed to be having the accent or are you trying to hide the accent and just failing? And I suspect it's the latter based upon how it sort of floats in and out throughout the film. And again, I feel bad because she's very clearly a young actor. She's, you know, just learning this. This is not something that many adult actors are capable of doing convincingly, certainly. See Hugh Jackman and his occasionally floating in Australian accent when playing a Canadian. But, I mean, it's definitely one of those things where it takes you a moment to realize, it's like, okay, yeah, that doesn't quite click. But they, I mean, it's a small thing in an otherwise good performance, but I noticed it, so it's kind of hard not to sort of note that it's there. But what about you? What would you be a second and final pit in this instance?
This is a minor thing, and I don't even think it's like anything that's anyone really notices. I kind of wish that there was some that, like, the movie opened with like some crazy like title sequence. I don't know, a lot of movies these days don't really have opening titles like that anymore, or design, and that's just something, considering that this was the final film, I kind of be like, nah, you know what, really go all out with it. Like I said, that was just like a little minor nitpick, just something that I kind of wish it had, you know, but I can't really say it. It failed because of that. Just something I wish it had.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Although, that funny enough, that does bring me to my final pit, which is the ending credits, actually enough, because if there's one thing I've noticed with the WWE productions, and let me be clear, this one's not nearly as bad as others. Mainly, I'm looking at you, Walking Tall, the Dwayne Johnson version, where there are one thing that some of these straight to video films, and because they usually want to hit that 85 to 90 minute long runtime, occasionally they need to pad things out. Now, the good news in this film is that, again, thanks to Chuck Norris's, you know, fine editing this film, not a minute's wasted in the movie. The thing is, it literally hits about the 80 minute mark at the end of the closing montage, goodbye here, which, you know, suddenly that's going to put you well below that 90 minute mark. So when you're looking at the credits, they are stretching it with big, huge gaps of blank screen as they scroll through it. There, or it's like, yep, we're just going to ride. Everybody's going to get your credit and everything's going to, you'll have multiple minutes to read everything that's on screen. And I get it. I get where you're coming from, but, you know, look, we're in the day and age of people enjoying micro content on YouTube here now. You know, people want their stuff in 15 minutes or less, it seems. You know, look at Quibi. It worked out well for them. But, you know, but I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know what, you don't have to stretch the ending credits out that long in this instance, particularly when your film is legitimately good. Nobody's going to complain that you got in and out and did your job effectively in the minimal amount of time required to still count as a feature-length film. So, I mean, particularly in the day and age of the massively overlong blockbuster. So, I'm just saying, you know, one thing that every direct-to-video film company should take a page of notes from. But with that, I guess this brings us to the end of this one. I'm not 100% sure what the next bonus episode is as of yet. Again, we're not really stringing these things together through connections in this instance. Although I suspect if it's the film that it's going to be, at least a few cast members from this film will be popping up in that film, because it's another UK-based direct-to-video production in this instance. But I won't spoil that title just yet, because for now, just in case the plan changes. But until then, Eric, thank you once again, first of all, for joining me for this conversation here. It's always a pleasure to get to talk to you. For our listeners, if they want to get in contact with you, where can they find both your work online and reach out to you personally?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at Deacon05OC, and I also have a blog that I write mostly about movies on deaconsden.wordpress.com. So yeah, if you ever want to check out any things that I'm writing about, I always could use more people reading. And if you're a fan of Alfred Hitchcock, you'll probably find something that I've written on there, because like most of the stuff I write is on Alfred Hitchcock films. It's not an Alfred Hitchcock blog. I just love his work. So that'll just be the majority of the stuff. But you can hit me up there, or you can, like I said, reach me on Twitter. I talk to Dave all the time. We're always talking movies and, movies, TV, comics, all those sorts of things.
Absolutely, and I highly recommend checking out Deacon's Den, folks. You will not regret it. If you want to reach me, you can find me at 24 Panels, at 24 Panels, at 24 Panels, where, yes, you can bring up the fact that I did not bring up how Daniel Adegboyega did appear in an episode of Doctor Who playing Ryan's dad, Aaron, a couple New Year specials ago there. I caught on it, I knew it, but there was no natural way to work it in, hence why I waited to the very end here, folks. But you can absolutely reach me there. Always happy to have a civil conversation. You can always rate and review the show on iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use. Apparently we are on something called FM Player. I still don't know what that is, but we're there apparently, so hey, check us out if you are listening to us there. Let me know. How did you find us? Why did you find us? I'm always curious to this. Otherwise, there is also an email address you can technically reach us at as well. I continue to as ever to forget what that email address is, so do not worry about it for now. That'll be Andrew's problem when he's back. So on that note here, when it comes right down to it, normally this is where I would throw to Andrew to see if he has any parting words he'd like to leave our listeners with. Did you happen to have anything you'd want to say to the listeners at home, Eric?
Learn what your movie interests are. Find a direct-to-video series. I'm quite sure that whatever your interest is, there is something out there for it. So give them a shot. You'll probably, like me, be very surprised.
Exactly. So on that note, folks, goodbye, and we'll see you next time.